On the Apache Kafka wiki, we find KIP328, famously entitled Ability to Suppress Updates for K-Tables. It turns out this is an interesting change to the Kafka Streams API in Apache Kafka 2.1. John Rosler, a Kafka Streams developer, is going to tell us what this is all about on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Welcome back, everyone, to Streaming Audio. I am, as ever, your host, Tim Berglund, and I have with me today in the virtual studio my coworker, John Rosler. John, welcome to Streaming Audio.
Hi, Tim. Thank you.
You bet. We're going to talk today about the world-famous KIP328 K-table update suppression. That's our topic, and I think there's a great deal of explanation required if you're not familiar with KIP328 to even get us in the ballpark. So we've got a lot to talk about. But before we do that, tell us about you. What do you do, John?
Well, I am a software engineer. I work primarily on Kafka Streams, and I've been doing that for almost exactly a year now. Before that, I work at Confluent. Before that, I worked at Bizarre Voice on their streaming data platform. They had an in-house streaming data platform, very similar to Kafka Streams.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah. And that's early adopters. I'm always reminded of Yelp. You know, they were a early adopter of kind of Kafka in more primitive times. And there's all these things that you have to build if you're going to take streaming seriously, right? Like, you're going to have to manage schemas. Okay, let's build a schema register.
Right.
And you're going to have some, you know, you'll see this repeated pattern of integrating with non-streaming systems. So you're going to build something like Kafka Connect. And you want to do computation over streams. And so you're like, okay, well, let me just write a big consumer. And you start to look and see there are patterns in your consumers. Like, over and over again, you're enriching one stream with another, and then you're computing an aggregate. And you just do that all the time. And you scale it, and you see the same problems that emerge when you try to scale that out with managing state and blah, blah, blah. And pretty soon, you've written Kafka Streams.
Right. Yeah. And that's basically exactly what happened when we started it. We sort of wandered into like, oh, we need this, and we need this, and we need this. And there just wasn't anything out there at the time.
Right.
So.
Right. And so you had to build it because you were Vanguard. Right. Now, for people who are adopting streaming, I always, and just for the record, if you're listening, we are talking about Kafka Streams today. So that's why this framework discussion, this KIP is a completely Kafka Streams related right. thing. When I talk to people about this stuff who are entering event streaming systems now, I'm always like, look, you know, you're going to have this temptation to build this stuff. But as Admiral Akbar would remind us, it's a trap.
Yes.
Because you can't. I mean, you will end up with, and I forget who said this, somebody said any sufficiently complex C program ends up containing a buggy partial implementation of Common Lisp in it. And so I tell people, that's probably Paul Graham who said that, but I tell people you will create a buggy partial implementation of Kafka Streams. Please don't. So that's why the framework is there, because you have to do computation over streaming data. And there are these patterns that emerge over and over again, specifically aggregating and enriching and filtering. And hey, look, the Kafka community made you this nice functional Java API that does that in a way that, you know, many, many people have invested in and many, many people are using. And it's, you know, relatively low incidence of bugs, and it's a good thing.
Yeah. And that was basically our experience. It took, I guess I worked on the project for about 6 years until it got to the point where it was like, okay, ready. And, you know, we were running all of the company's data through it and it was performing well. We were like, okay, cool. We got it. Let's switch to Kafka Streams now. Cause it's out there now.
Right. We're done with ours and it's still not as good as Kafka Streams. So, and it can't be, I mean, cause that's not your business. Your business is whatever it is. You have customers to take care of. And like the Kafka community's business is creating a world-class stream processing system in the case of people who work on Kafka Streams. So you can't ever, that's the framework trap. You can't ever invest enough in your custom framework because there's somebody yelling at you for features that your customers want. So, now I'm just going to make some assumptions that if you're listening, you know what Kafka is. And if you're not familiar with Kafka streams, you know, you probably have gotten the idea already that it's this functional Java API that does higher level stream processing things, the sorts of things we've been talking about, which is probably prolegomenon enough to talk about this kip. But to get us there, the name of the kip is ktable update suppressions. I think it is fair to give people a little bit of an account of what a ktable is. And this has happened on previous streaming audio episodes, but maybe you're joining us for the first time. John, walk us through ktables. Like, start me with a Kafka topic and that has things in it and get me to a ktable and tell me how and why. And
okay,
I'll probably interrupt you a few times along the way.
Sure. So I suppose the basic idea is if you rewind the clock, you know, back maybe 5 years ago, and look at what people mean when they say stream processing. They're generally just talking about taking a stream of events, you know, maybe website clicks or ad impressions or something, chopping it up into time windows, and then counting like the number of live sessions, you know, in each 5 minute window or something like that. So that I guess was the only thing that people were using sort of stream processing frameworks for a long time. And then relatively recently, people started to realize that you can do a lot of the stuff that you were previously doing with MapReduce or even database queries in sort of a live fashion using
like event at a time, right, kind of thing.
And then when you start to look at stream processing in that way, it sort of, I guess you realize how you can generalize the thing to the problem of computing a materialized view. So for example, if you look at if you look at MySQL, inside the database is this transaction log where, you know, I do a write, that writes gets written down in the log, and then MySQL will go and like update all the indices and tables and data structures and stuff. And then I go and do another write and the same thing happens again. So there's, alongside the actual database, there's this transaction log that's there inside the database.
So what we think of, and at the API level, the correct abstraction for a developer who doesn't want to go insane is insert or update. I mean, that's how you change something in a database or delete. But inside, in fact, those requests to mutate the state of the database get logged in a transaction log, and then other processes inside the database consume that log and go do other stuff, like change tables and update indexes and whatever needs to happen to satisfy the data model and consistency guarantees and all that stuff that the database exposes in its contract. The database is like a consumer off this stream of mutation
requests. Yeah, and the main thing that's for is disaster recovery. So if the database crashes and then it restarts and all of its data files are just, you know, garbage, then at the very least, it can replay the transaction log and rebuild the entire state. And one of the neat things that you can do with that is if you have, let's say you have your main database and you're doing all your writes into it, but you want to separate your read workload from the write workload, you can actually subscribe another MySQL database to that first database's transaction log. And then the second one will mirror the state of the first one.
Okay.
And so that
account of a database as the, you know, a series of consumers of an event stream is highly tendentious. You know, nobody ever describes a database that way, but it happens to set us up very well for kind of our streaming view of the world. It's like a good framing.
Yeah. So you can start to think about taking that same transaction log and just dumping it into a Kafka topic, for example, and then consuming that Kafka topic, not from maybe another MySQL database, but from another kind of database entirely. Or if you're Kafka Streams, you can read that transaction log and build the same state into a K table, basically. So a K table is essentially a materialized view of, well, one thing it could be is a materialized view of a, you know, a database table that you have sort of hosted somewhere else.
Right. But at a minimum, a K table is, so that, you know, we were talking about a relational database and its transaction log on disk. So replace that transaction log with a Kafka topic containing whatever, like we don't know, but some series of events, and you can make the same decision like, you know, the database as consumer of transaction log in Kafka streams. You can take that topic and, you know, make it into a table, basically consume the events and materialize them into this tabular view of the data. So that same analogy, that's in your mind, is that a fair description of what a K-table is?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, essentially it is, I mean, that's why it's called a K-table, is it's basically a table. Right. It is part of Kafka streams. And so it has this streaming aspect to it, but the right way to think about it is just a table. So when you interact with it, for example, using interactive query, you can.
And that, just to clarify the data model a little bit, key and value are the things. And so generally you'll have, well, I mean, it's a key value store. It's just that you get to structure the value and the key in arbitrary ways, right? Like the value could be some blob of JSON or an Avro record or what have you.
Sure, sure. Just like other key values, you know, databases, you can sort of put whatever you want in there, anything that can be serialized and deserialized from to and from a byte array.
Right, cool. How about the, like, the physical constitution of a K-table? I feel like this is going to get us, this is important to get us to what this KIP is all about. How, like, what form does one take when you start asking that question about, say, a MySQL table? You know, you'll talk about, well, ways the records are stored on disk, and, you know, B-tree indexes, and, you know, you could get into the read path of MySQL and all that stuff. But what is that, you know, to an appropriate level of detail, what is the physical constitution of a Kafka Streams K-table?
Sure. So the K-table, I guess when you actually, you know, build a K-table, the simplest thing you can do is you, you know, when you're setting up your streams topology, you can just tell it, hey, subscribe to this topic and turn it into a K-table. And what it'll do is it'll treat that topic as a transaction log in sort of just the same way that we were saying earlier, you could do with a secondary MySQL database. So it'll just treat that topic as a transaction log. Every record in that topic has a key. And as it reads the topic, it'll just consider whatever value is there to be the current state of that key. And it'll write it into a, you have different options for how to actually store the table, the current state of the table. But by default, you know, we have an in-memory one that's a, basically just a Java hash map. And then there's a on-disk one that uses RocksDB.
Gotcha. RocksDB seems to be an increasingly important component to know about when trying to understand distributed systems like Kafka. It seems like it's popping its head up more and more all over the place. So not a surprise to see it in Kafka Streams either. So in the case of RocksDB, which is the default, is it a decent first-order approximation for me to think this K-table exists as an in-memory key-value store? I mean, I can just to get started with, I can think of it that way, right?
Okay, that's fair.
So yeah, so we're reading, consuming messages or events from a topic, and kind of like, you know, putting them in this in-memory hash table key-value store thing. And there's so much more to the story in the case of RocksDB, and I think that would be interesting to explore on a future episode. Really, kind of deep dive into that for people who are into it. But basically, it's a key-value store in memory now, and all of the questions, dear listener, that might come up in your mind when I say in memory, like, wait, how's that going to scale? I mean, there are really good and elegant answers to those. And if we were doing nothing but talking about Kafka Streams K-tables today, we could get into them. But just for now, let me wave my podcast hands and say, it's okay, it scales, don't worry. There are great ways to scale it horizontally, elastically, super cool. So we now have a topic, and this Kafka Streams process is consuming messages from that topic or events from that topic, putting them in this in-memory hash table that's sort of implemented by and supported by RocksDB. And give me some examples of things I can do. And I guess right away, I just made some assumptions. And this is the simplest way to get started thinking about a table is consuming a topic and turning that topic into a table. But there are other things I can do in streams that will result in a table that aren't just that I have this topic and I want a hash table materialized view of it, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So give me another example of how else I can make a table, and I'm going somewhere with this. So just what's some other way I could make a table?
So I guess branching off from the point where we just built a table from sort of naively from a stream, I'd say the next big thing that pops up in streams is producing tables from other tables by doing some operations on it. And this, you can draw an analogy back to something that's very common in traditional databases. When you get to scale, you discover that your, 47 line MySQL query with 10 joins in it, you can't.
Which
do
all
that
seemed like a good idea at the
500,000
time.
500,000 times a second.
Yeah. No, you can't. You can run that maybe once every 500,000 seconds.
Right. One thing that you can do in the traditional database world is set up a materialized view. So basically what it does, and I believe I could be wrong, so I could be embarrassing myself on the internet right now, but
I do it all the time.
Yeah. I believe what MySQL actually does is it subscribes to the transaction log and does essentially sort of like a stream processing thing where it, when there's a new event, then you sort of, have this hook subscribed to compute your materialized view. It figures out which rows need to be updated to, it'll do all your joins and stuff and then update it in an output table. And then you can query the output table, which is just basically a materialization of the query that you wrote up this query. You told it, okay, now just make it like I queried that on every single row in the database and actually store the result, so that I can just query the result very quickly, as many times a second as I want to. Huh. And you can basically do the same thing with streams. So you can say, okay, here's these five input tables, five topics, turn them all into tables. You can join them all together. You can, do some aggregations on them, filter out some records or, split records out into multiple other records, do a bunch of joins, and then spit the result out into a K-table.
Into it. So basically making a K-table out of something that really I had no intention of any one of these particular topics becoming a K-table, but I made one.
Right.
Yeah. You said aggregate, and that rings a bell, because if I aggregate, I'm grouping probably. And if I am grouping a stream, the contents of a stream, like logically that ends up making a table. You take, you're grouping by some key, whether that's literally the key, or you're grouping by something you're picking out of the message value or whatever it is you're doing. Mm-hmm. You're grouping up events in the stream over some window by that key. And the data structure that results from that conceptually is a table. So you can take a stream that's just a stream. It's a stream of, your fleet of vehicles has little GPS receivers in them and they're on an LTE network, and twice a second they're producing their current location to some MQTT proxy, and it's landing in a Kafka cluster somewhere in some data center, and you are consuming that stream and grouping by something, and that's going to make a table out of that event stream.
Right.
So that table, and imagine I group and I filter and like all that stuff you were just talking about, I write an interesting Kafka Streams application to do, non-trivial computation over that event stream, I still wind up with a table. Where does that, what can I do with that table now? I understand that it is an in-memory thing, that it's a, RocksDB table, and maybe RocksDB is persisting that to disk. Maybe it's not, but What can I do with it at that point? I don't want it to just be this ephemeral thing in memory. How do I get it back out into Kafka to where I could then go Kafka connected into a database or some other system I'm integrating with, or, you know, whatever it is I'm doing? How do I get out?
Actually, it used to be the case that you could just tell Kafka Streams, hey, take this table and write it to a topic. But recently we sort of clarified the API a little bit so that all of the operations on a K table are table like operations. But there is this one operator called toStream. So you basically tell Kafka Streams, okay, so take this K table, this, you know, grouped aggregated monstrosity that we just produced from the fleet of vehicles, you know, real time updates.
Right.
And interpret it not as a key value table, but basically sort of expose the transaction log, expose the stream of state transitions that the table goes through as it, all these computations get triggered, as a new event comes in and triggers this cascade of computations through the materialization, that'll cause, you know, one or more state changes in the resulting K table. And you can view those state changes as like a timeline. So that's what happens when you call toStream on a K table. And then from that point, now you're dealing with a regular stream, and it's sort of trivially easy to see how you just dump that stream into a Kafka topic. And then you can go from there into another database or whatever you want to do with
whatever
it.
Else, or you have other, you know, microservices in your system that are now going to consume that event stream and do whatever. Like, you don't even need to know. It's just a Kafka topic. So that, and that, I think that is clear enough. Once you have that K table and it is being computed in real time, you know, at on an event at a time basis from whatever the inputs are and whatever the kind of graph of computations that you've defined in your Kafka Streams app. If you just kind of locate your mind at that table and think the table is being mutated, there are new things being inserted and old things being updated. There are not literally inserts and updates on this table, but, you know, think of it that way.
Right.
When those happen, those mutation events, as it were, get produced in this toStream call as new messages to that Kafka topic.
Right.
That's a correct summary. Yeah. So simple enough. We go from stream to interesting graph of computations in Kafka Streams to in-memory table and potentially then back to stream. And the naive approach to that is, well, anytime something in that table changes, I best produce me a message to the topic so everybody knows about it.
Yeah.
So completing the story, the first, when we were, you know, I asked you to describe what a K-table is. We started with the MySQL transaction log analogy and extended that to a topic that had events. And we said, we can just read those events in and make them into a table. I could do that same thing in another application with that topic. I could now read that in and get, recreate that K-table in some other microservice maintained by some other team who doesn't have access to or want to care about my code. You know, they get to basically integrate with that event stream and they could make it into a new K table. But if it's a giant fleet of vehicles all updating twice a second, then there's an awful lot of mutations to that table and there's an awful lot of events being produced to that topic. Now, there are ways to manage that, but still, it's like noise and maybe you don't need that resolution.
Right.
Which gets us to the beloved KIP 328. Tell us, those were K table updates we were just describing. So tell us about this. And is our analogy breaking down in any way? What is KIP 328 all about?
Yeah. So, you're right that, especially if you think about data streams coming in at very high frequency or very complicated, computational graphs happening before you get to this table state that then you want to like spit out into a topic or do something else with, then you can wind up with a very high number of updates to the table. And I don't know, maybe almost certainly you don't care about seeing every single update actually be stored in that output topic. Maybe you do, but for
if you do, you know who you are.
Right. So now there is this one nuance here that that concern that says, you know, hey, you know, cool, we have this, you know, stream processing program that, you know, does all this whiz bang stuff with our data, and it produces, you know, 2.5 million updates per second. And now I'm paying to store, you know, to send all those bytes over my network and to store them, you know, in this Kafka broker and all this stuff. So I want to cut down on that because I don't need every single event. I just need, you know, maybe up to the last second or up to the last minute. So then I guess the observation that we made in Kafka Streams a while back was that that concern is not an algorithmic concern, right? When you think about the computation that you're expressing by doing joins and aggregations and stuff, it's sort of a different thing. You're thinking at that point about how do I write a correct program to compute the things I need to compute. It's not necessary to think about how many updates is this going to produce a second at that point.
Right.
So what we did is we sort of separated those concerns. So in Kafka Streams, you have this thing called a record cache, and you can configure, you know, the size of this record cache, and you can also configure how frequently it flushes stuff out. And that was our answer for, you know, cutting out, you know, cutting down the super high frequency of updates. You know, basically we'll put in these caches, they'll sort of soak up the high frequency updates and then just emit like the latest state once a second or something. It's configurable.
Nice.
But
it sounds that you make it sound simple.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Very simple. and you know, that works. People find it a little bit difficult to tune those parameters to get exactly the desired outcome sometimes. But for people who don't, you know, who don't really care exactly what pattern comes out, what pattern of updates comes out of the table, and they just want to say, you know, like, hey, take my network traffic and divide it by 1,000. You know, they can pretty easily just, you know, slap in a reasonably big cache, set the time, you know, the cache flushing time to some reasonably large number, and it'll just soak up all those updates and give them what they want. And I would say that what we came to realize after sort of putting out this record caching feature and making this, you know, sort of taking this strong stance that the controlling the pattern of updates is purely an operational concern, is that actually there are some use cases where you need to have very specific control over what pattern the updates that come out of a particular k-table are. So,
okay.
One example is just, you know, you have, you know, maybe you have some application and just hypothetically you're producing, it's building two different k-tables, two different streams. And one of those is you're going to take the events and you're going to ship them off to some other, you know, third-party system or microservice or something. And for that one, you want to impose a strict rate limit. But the other one, you don't. Maybe the other one you want to have like these super granular events because, you know, your use case or whatever demands it. So that's one thing that you can't do with the record caching thing is record caching is a global configuration for the whole streaming topology. So if you want to exercise specific control over like what are the different rates of these different streams in my application, that's something that we needed this new feature for.
Got it. And this now is an API level thing. So in a particular streams topology where I'm creating a table and I want to, is it still, and by the way, this is not feigned ignorance. I actually don't know. Is this still through the agency of two stream call?
No. And that actually was something that we wrestled with for quite a while. And if you go back and look at the mailing list, we sort of went back and forth and back and forth on this. The suppression feature is kind of a weird feature to have in the Ktable API itself. I said a little bit earlier that all of the operations on Ktables are table-like operations, but when you start trying to shape the sequence of events that, you know, the sequence of updates the table spits out, you're no longer talking about a table-like operation. That's a stream-like operation.
Right.
And so it did, for a while, it seemed like, you know, maybe this should be something that you call to stream and then you can shape the events. But that, I would say that that didn't actually, like, it wasn't simple. And one of the goals always for the Kafka Streams DSL is to make simple things simple. So it seemed like that was too high a price to pay in terms of API complexity.
Got it. And good call on that. It's because Kafka Streams is amazingly elegant, and you know, I love the power and the kind of the operational model. Is I think it makes all the right decisions. It does scare people at first, right? I have to help people get over that. Like, no, you can do this. It's okay. You know, and you know it very well. It's not scary anymore, but for new people, it is. And so reducing the complexity of the surface is a thing that, well, I mean, that's like one of the jobs of my whole team at Confluent is to help that kind of thing happen. So
right.
I like that. Not that my team at Confluent gets to dictate what Kafka Streams does, but hey, we can make suggestions on mailing lists like anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely.
So no, that is a good call. And that just seems like the right place to place that abstraction, because it is where you think of it, right? You think of it as a table thing. So,
yeah, it's actually only, it only makes sense in a table context. So if you think of like a stream of raw events, you know, like this truck was at this GPS location and then a second later it was at a different one. Those are two different events. So there's no way to sort of compress those into one event sort of just by saying, hey, don't send me updates so frequently. Cause we'll just, you know, less frequently, we'll send you twice as, you know, like half as frequently, we'll send you twice as many events. So you still get all the same events.
Just batched.
Right. But if you're in a table context and you say, okay, let's aggregate that data into a table. So now we have just the truck's ID is the key and its current location is the value. Then you can say, okay, well, we won't send you every single update. Just once a second, we'll send you the last, you know, reported location of it.
Right.
So that's where suppression makes sense. That's the other reason it didn't seem to be a good idea to put it in the Kstream API.
Yeah. In the interface of that class, of the Kstream class, you mean?
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Cool. Well, I mean, that makes sense to me. And I think that's the kip. Is there more?
There is a little bit more. So, and this is actually, we're sort of getting to the most important use case of this feature is final updates. So one thing, it's a special case of like people who actually do care about the sequence of updates is some people who use Kafka Streams want to take some action based on an event like, oh, I don't know, they're doing a windowed computation. So they're windowing up their website traffic in like 1 hour chunks. And they would like to send an alert if the website gets zero hits within a 5 minute window, right? Because maybe that means the website's down or something's misconfigured. And it turns out that unless you have a really strong API feature to do that, like suppression, there's really no reliable way to do that. Because, you know, if you think about the way that windows are formed, you have this event stream, you sort of chop it up into 5 minute segments.
Right.
And as each, you know, you're consuming these events one at a time. So you're consuming the stream one event at a time, you start a new segment, you read in you know, one, two, you're just counting these events. One, two, three, right? You get to the end of the window, you start a new window, you start over.
Yeah, you reset your count.
Right. So let's make the example a little bit more complicated. So if we say we want to fire an alert when for any 5-minute segment where our website gets less than 10 hits, well, every 5-minute segment has less than 10 hits until it gets 10, until you process 10 events, right? So you start a new 5-minute window, it has 0 hits at that point. Well, you don't want to fire an alert because you haven't read all the events yet.
Uh-huh. Your 5 minutes aren't up. And the way windows work is they're not batches. You know, it's just, there's the count. So you're essentially firing the alert until you get 11 hits.
Right. Yeah.
All the time is what you're saying. Every 5 minutes you get an alert. Okay. Yeah. That's terrible.
Yeah. And then you sort of want to take it back. You get to, you count, you're counting 8, 9, 10, 11, and you've been firing alerts this whole time. And then you're like, oh, actually, don't worry about that. That window, it was fine.
Okay. Okay.
Right. That's not the way alerting works. I don't want to wake up all night.
No, that is not.
Right, like that.
Yeah, there's a parable about a little boy who did that, and no one ignored him when the wolf actually came. So,
exactly, yep. That led people to ask us, okay, how do we know when the window is done? How do we know when what is the final result of this window? And that concept was not actually, there's no event that happens. You know, you might get all of your website hits or whatever in the first minute, and then nothing else happens for the rest of the 5 minutes. And in that case, events would only flow through Kafka Streams when they have some reason to exist. So there's no like event that gets fired when the window hits its end. It's just that the next event that comes in is past the end of the window, so it makes a new one and so forth. So one thing that people tried to do was they tried to use the record cache, you know, set it to flush at a coarser granularity than their window size. But that only works if you have only one size of window in your application. And it also isn't, you know, it's not a strong guarantee that the flush events are going to line up exactly with the ends of your windows. If you have all of your events come in at the beginning of the window and then nothing else happens, there's going to be no further event that flows through the K table that says, okay, this window is now closed.
Oh, totally. Cause it's just events on the input topic that are in fact the events. And if a window closes, then that closing of the window actually happens on the next event. Streams is like, well, oh, okay, new window, but there isn't any timer that's expiring that says, hey, your window's up.
Right. It doesn't say, oh, by the way, this other window is now closed. It just says, okay, well, here's your new window. Here's your new count for your new window.
Makes perfect sense.
So we did two things to sort of make this happen. One is we changed up the window definition a little bit. So now when you create a windowed stream, you tell it how much to chop the stream up in, and then you also give it a grace period. So you say, you know, hey, chop my stream up into 5-minute segments, and then allow, you know, an extra, I don't know, 3 minutes for late arriving events. And then what that allows us to do is, so basically what Streams does at that point is you get some events come in. Basically, let's just say that you have, one of your servers is just running slow, for example. So it doesn't send its events as promptly as the other ones do.
Right.
So you can have an event come in at, 9 o'clock in the morning, but it's actually dated, 8:53 or something.
Sure.
So that should go into the 8:50 bucket, right? It shouldn't go into the 9 a.m. bucket because it's an 8:53 event.
Right.
So what you can do with grace period is you basically say, okay, let's allow up to 3 minutes for events to be late, and then otherwise we just don't care about them. You know, they're sort of too late. Right. Events could be arbitrarily late, so it makes sense to just kind of draw a line somewhere and balance like how prompt do I want my alerts to be versus how late do I think events in my streams can be. So let's just say you do 5-minute windows with 3-minute grace period. That means that 8 minutes after a window starts, you know that there will be no further updates to that window. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. that 3-minute grace period. You need to wait in case any data arrives late.
Right. So then what we can do in suppression. So basically in suppression, the way that it works, you know, sort of in regular mode is you just tell it, you know, hey, suppress, you know, you got my incoming data stream, and just sort of suppress events for some amount of time. You can say, you know, 30 seconds or an hour or whatever you want to say. And every time it gets an event, it'll just hang on to it for the specified amount of time. And then any further events that'll come in, it'll just update the latest state of that key until the time elapses. And then it'll just spit out whatever was the latest state.
Okay.
So with the grace period and the window, like with the window lifecycle, where we know after 8 minutes after a window starts, there will be no further updates, then actually suppression can just piggyback on that and say, okay, well, suppress events from this windowed K table for 8 minutes. So then 8 minutes after the window starts, it'll spit out the latest result that it saw for that window. And we just happen to know that another event will never come through for that window. So that, you know, it's another way of saying that that's the final result of that computation.
Yeah, that window is gone. So, okay. So that's allowed you to restructure how that's handled internally.
Yep. And what it lets you do, I guess, as a user is you can say, you know, hey, for this windowed K table, only spit out the final results. And then now it's just sort of really trivial to build an alerting application on that or send out emails or, you know, whatever you want to do.
Exactly. So a couple of use cases there that are opened up and not hard, whereas before you were building infrastructure on the back end of your streams topology to handle that. And like we talked about earlier, the whole point here is that you don't have to build that kind of infrastructure because that's not the business right. You're in. So we've kind of pulled a little bit of that thing back into the API proper, which is kind of a cool thing about Kafka generally is that I like how things like streams and connect and schema registry and how these things have evolved. Schema registry is not a Apache thing, it's a Confluent thing, but it's still sort of broadly a community component. These show up like after people have demonstrated, hey, this is a problem. Like we said at the beginning, if you are serious about event streaming and all you have is Kafka 0.8, you know, you're going to build these things because you need them. And what that means is this is the old, and I'm blanking on his name, the guy who wrote Perl. I can't believe
Larry
it.
Larry Ellison, right? Larry Wall.
Larry Wall. Yeah. Larry Wall is the other, yep. Or Ellison's the other guy. Of course, Larry Wall, you know, the paving the path where the grass gets worn down rather than, you know, designing ahead of time saying, I'm going to make, you know, put concrete here. You look for where people are walking and put concrete there. That's kind of like the Kafka community's approach to stuff like this. And I think this KIP, the reason why I want to talk about it, two reasons. One is it's technically interesting and it lets us explore worthwhile parts of the API and get insight into how things are put together on the inside. And also it's a good example of seeing, oh, hey, yeah, this is stuff that people were doing. Let's expand the boundary of the API to here so that that takes over that little piece of infrastructure that people had to build their own buggy partial implementations of, because, you know, we don't want to make them do that.
Right. Yeah. I think that that is a really good approach to API design. As an engineer, one of the things I've noticed is, you know, sometimes the instinct is just to do everything that you can do, you know, like when you put together this library or some API, you know, you sort of like, oh, you could do this and we can do this and that and that. And what you wind up with is a very complex system to use. If you start with the simplest thing that you think people are going to want to do, and then, you know, wait until more than one person comes along and says, hey, I want to do this other thing. You know, on the downside, it's a bummer maybe that your API isn't just like fully powerful right out of the gate. But on the other hand, you have some confidence that not only do you only have, you know, you're not forcing people to make choices about things that don't matter to them. So you only have choices presented that actually matter to people. And when you design the specific API, you know, the way it works and stuff, you have some knowledge about the way that it's going to be used rather than just having to imagine it whole cloth.
Very well put. My guest today has been John Roesler. John, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. It's an honor.
And there you have it. I hope that was helpful to you. If you've got questions, you can ask me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on any of our YouTube videos. Your question might be featured on the next episode of Streaming Audio. And feel free to subscribe to our YouTube channel and this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast and just generally helps us get the word out. We appreciate your support. See you next time.